Hello everyone, and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And this is part two of my recent chat with bass player to the stars and all-round rock and roll raconteur Guy Pratt, who has been a familiar sight on YouTube of late with his lockdown lick series of bass demos, in which he shows us the bass lines that he played on hits including Like a Prayer, Earth Song, Murder on the Dance Floor, and loads more, including some of the Pink Floyd numbers he performs when he was playing for them in the late 80s and early 90s, and currently as part of Nick Mason's Saucer Full of Secrets live experience. Well, I say currently, you know what I mean. Anyway, so here we are for the second part of the chat we had about Lodger a couple of weeks back, and it's one of those conversations where we do head off piece quite a bit. So this isn't going to be the most forensic analysis of Bowie's 1979 album that you'll have ever heard, but as we cover everything from Guy's former father-in-law Rick Wright to what it's like playing with Pink Floyd, 60s-sounding keyboards, Robert Palmer, lots of Kraftwerk. We recorded this actually just before the death of Florian Schneider. We talk about trench coats, we talk about Talking Heads, New York, Switzerland, and also why krautrock running playlists just don't work. Anyway, I think there's plenty to enjoy here. So have a listen, and if you do like this episode, please do share us as ever on your social channels and spread the word. It really means a lot. So anyway, we're going to pick up straight away. Guy and myself, we're hovering on the edge of the hinterland, and we're going to sail to the hinterland. We had done Up to Your Assassin. Yes, you had made the very good point.
We did just ask
the two-tone and reference. After we spoke and I listened back to it, and I thought, you know what? I totally see what you mean. It's got that very... Is that a Farfisa?
Because
that is
what...
What's his name? In The Attractions was playing, wasn't it? For Elvis Costello.
It was a Vox, actually. That was a Vox. But Vox and Farfisa were very similar. They were
right,
the 60s
quite a, yes. The garage.
The thing is, unlike a Hammond, they were kind of cheap. They were cheap and portable. They're what Rick used to play with Floyd. In fact, his one was amazing because the keys were the other way around. The black notes were white and the white notes were black. Very cool look.
Really?
Mm.
Why was that?
I don't know. It was the 60s, man.
But is that what he was using to make that really distinctive sound then on Arnold Lane?
And again, he had, you know, there's one of my great regrets, which is seeing as I knew Rick so well, you know, he was my son's grandfather. Mm. I sailed the Atlantic with him and, you know, and he was such a close friend. And I had this one question I always wanted to ask him and I never, ever did, which is where was the inspiration for that? It's very similar to this Assassin thing, to the fact that all those early, so all the stuff on Arnold Lane and Emily and everything was Eastern, but not Indian. It was Eastern. It was like Arabic kind of scale. There was no blues reference or anything. And it never occurred to me to ask it. And he was like the only guy doing that. Where the fuck did that come from? And
it was kind of in the air at the time though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But only, not really. I mean, you had sort of George Harrison was playing a sitar and Indian stuff was all very groovy, but it was, it's like there were no guitarists apart from a bit of sitar. It seemed a really odd thing. And then for some reason, that whole thing became associated with ska. And I don't know if that came from original ska. And then actually, do you know the next place that sort of, that place turned up was in the early days of house and techno. All those acid house, all those records were. He does that on a lot. I mean, it was his go-to thing, really.
I think my favourite song of that period is "Remember a Day."
It is a Rick song, yeah, which I sing with Sourceful.
Do you?
Oh, man. It is a fantastic song.
It's one of my favourite songs.
Yeah, that kind of why can't everything just be great? It was great when we were little. Why can't we just keep it like that forever? And you want to go, mate, you're only fucking 22.
But again, that was in the air at the time, wasn't it? That kind of, you know, child, I think maybe because of everyone was doing colossal amounts of acid, but, you know, that kind of child's eye view of the world and, you know, childhood being this place to come back to. It's all like a very spooky child's eye view of the world.
Also, you've got to bear in mind that these people's childhoods were immediately post-war.
Yeah.
So I think that childhood was quite black and white and grey. And and again, this incredibly repressed generation of parents who'd just been through fucking unimaginable shit. And of course, clammed up, you know, there's all sorts of political reasons for that, given the 60s. So I do think a reason, because for a lot of that Alice in Wonderland, right, thing, is that there was this. There was this kind of idealized childhood that perhaps people didn't have because it was rationing and bomb sites. And so I think that might be, in a way like the Michael Jackson thing of perpetually chasing a childhood you never had.
Were you in the band in the days after Rick died? David Gilmour did that on Jules Holland.
Yeah, I was, because it'd been arranged for us to do that. And then, and then Rick died, but we thought, sod it, we'll do it anyway. That's why we did Remember a Day. We'd never done that before. We did that specially.
I really remember David's voice on that. You know, it just, the grief, there's grief in his voice. Beautiful, beautiful, heartfelt rendition. Well, I'm glad that's the song you sing. That's a really special song to me.
Well, it's nice because I actually do a thing I probably won't on the next one, the last tour, where I introduce it when I say, this is all about childhood and looking back. And it's particularly poignant for me because it was written by my son's grandfather. And he was a great granddad, by the way. He was brilliant. Lovely. He was he just totally undermined anything you tried to do as parents. Totally naughty.
But that's what you want in a granddad, isn't it?
That's your job, isn't it? Exactly. It's the ultimate. It's the perfect parent. It's all the good bits of being a parent. It's like, it turns up, you love it, it goes away.
You must really miss him.
Yeah, I do, terribly, I must say.
After I spoke to you last time, I think they put out on the Pink Floyd channel, you on stage, and because I remember I was watching out for you, and I was thinking, I've just chatted to that bloke. And you seem to be making faces at Nick Mason.
No, Pulse wasn't the other week.
And every time the camera goes to you, kind of grinning at Nick behind the drums quite a bit, which is quite funny. And
I'm always grinning at everyone. That was sort of, it's always been, I was very happy, but it was, that's always been my job because I tend to move around a lot. It's my job is to keep everyone in touch. So I'm the sort of link, which I like. I do that with the sources a lot, but I love it. I love being that kind of common point of contact between everyone. I'm a DJ, I am one.
Explores a new quality of life as The Lodger on RCA Records.
So we're coming back to Lodger, and we're going to go straight into my favourite song on the album, which is Red Sails. And Red Sails is an absolute banger.
Yeah, it's got that weird... slightly hokey. It's quite funny. I don't think you'd be able to get away with it now. It's the thing, Brian did it with Tokyo Joe and, of course, Hong Kong Garden. That's sort of comedy oriental, which I always hated, by the way, as a song. I like some of the lyrics, but I don't like the song.
The comedy oriental, exactly, which Bowie does in China Girl as well, doesn't he?
Yeah. So, by the way, it's the easiest thing. It's all the black notes. It's all the black notes. That's how you do it. You can if you want to just write Balinese music, just play random black notes and you'll get nice. Because they're all pretty. There's nothing that's discordant with another note.
But you've got underneath together. It, you've got this very tough, motoric German beat. The band Harmonia from the 70s had a track called Monza, Rauf und Runter. And this is pretty much a direct lift from the rhythm track of Rauf und Runter.
We'll be right back.
swashbuckling homoerotic fantasy trip across the sea. Some people just think of it as a sort of a surreal story about travel. Bowie himself apparently said it's about Chinese English mercenaries on the China Sea. So take your pick.
Well, if that's what Bowie says, then it must be. See, like with all those things of Bowie, there's something in it that sounds like an actual reference to something that happened, doesn't it? Do you remember We Another Green and Black and Red and So Scared? Graffiti on the wall kept us all in tune. I mean, there's a night out involved in this.
It could well be that, couldn't it?
And yeah, probably. I'm slightly skeptical as I don't think Bowie liked anything to go out that didn't actually, you know, if the cut up thing worked to serve his process, then yes, you know, he would absolutely use it. But I think he didn't like things to go out that were actually meaningless. Because I'm sure there's a million ways you can use cut up where it will serve a purpose.
You fond of that sort of genre?
I am in retrospect. I wasn't really at the time. I didn't really have an item for it. But, well, I was very young. I'm currently running to a krautrock playlist. Yeah, I love it. Now, a lot of it seems so way ahead of its time. All the tempos are slightly wrong. It's so, I can't find, I don't know if it's, I hate running. I've never run before in my life. I'm now running every fucking day. And I can't find anything that seems to fit my tempo. Disco's no good. Rockstar, nothing works. So if anyone listening could give, I don't know what my, you know, I don't know what my running speed is.
Can't you get those special playlists which are curated so that they...
Yes, they don't work. I've been through Spotify. I've been through all of them. And, well, I actually haven't been through all of them. I've looked up running playlists and like disco running. But I thought, what could be better than running to disco? But none of them work.
Do you have a strange gait?
No, it's just straight out the garden onto the street. Boom, boom!
I'm here all week.
Yeah, try the veal. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I have an odd speed. I don't know. But anyway, Krautrock.
There are all these stories about how he became very close to Kraftwerk in the mid-70s. He even went asparagus shopping with Florian Schneider of Kraftwerk, because, as you know, Germans are very fond of asparagus season, now being the asparagus season. And this asparagus shopping led to Bowie asking Kraftwerk to support him on the Isolar tour. And then Kraftwerk said, no, we don't do that. And Wolfgang Fleur, the drummer, said in his biography sometime later, you know what, that was, you know, Kraftwerk were very self-contained. They didn't want to collaborate with other people. They could have reached billions with that. But what he did was then he would open his shows with Kraftwerk. So people coming to see his shows would enter the auditorium with Kraftwerk blasting away. Apparently, one of those people was Madonna. When they played Detroit in 76, Madonna was in the audience. She was 18 years old or something. And she said that it had a big influence on her. So there you go.
Oh, there you do indeed. My favourite Kraftwerk story is that Ralph got success. Well, they were all rich, weren't they? Wasn't he the son of some Ralph industrialist? Yeah. I mean, they were just loaded anyway. But he got so obsessed with sort of noise. Well, it was just noise he was interested in, sound. And he got so worried about, obsessed with noise pollution, that he got to the point where at Kling Klang, there was, he had all the, even the bells were turned off in the phones. And so if you wanted to speak to him, apparently you had to get a message to him that you were going to call him at 3:30, and he would pick up the phone at 3:30, but he wouldn't allow the noise of a phone or anything.
Do you remember that Tomorrow's World clip? It's quite a famous clip on YouTube now of the Tomorrow's World team visiting
No!
in 1975. Oh, it's wonderful, because you have a very plummy BBC announcer. This is Kraftwerk. It's work in their studios in Düsseldorf.
Kraftwerk have a name for this. It's machine music. Sounds are created at their laboratory in Düsseldorf, programmed, then recreated on stage with the minimum of fuss. This is Autobahn. They say the group on the rhythm of trucks, cars and passing bridges heard while driving through Germany.
I will do. I see recently was this thing of apparently, I think it was their first TV appearance. And it's on some German TV show. And it's fucking mental. It's absolutely, and so vibey. And it's not like the kind of, you know, the Republican presidential debate that they ended up looking like. And it's like full on kind of vibing away on synths and it's real drums. It's great.
One other thing I want to talk about, which we'll get to very much so in the next track, and is the Talking Heads influence, which we've also brought up yes. in the past. But Brian Eno had produced the last two Talking Heads albums, and here there's really a big David Byrne moment when he does the far, 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 far away. You know, that to me is a real homage to David Byrne. On this album, he's really singing in a lot of different styles. He's doing his deliberately bad style of singing here.
There was a funny thing. I remember listening to, is it Loving the Alien or something, with Robert Palmer. And because the first time I met Robert, the night I met Robert Palmer, in fact, was the night that Bowie came to see us, same see Ice House playing Germany. And Rob, I'd been sitting in the reception of the hotel with a couple of the band, and Robert Palmer suddenly put his head through the palm trees, through these potted plants, and went, you're the guy with the little stick. You got a thing going on and we need to talk. I'll see you later. And I was like, what the fuck just happened? And he then went off and had dinner with David Bowie. And I managed to get myself a spot where I could see through into the restaurant and I could see Robert and David. And I just sat there pretending to chat up the girl from the record company whilst desperately trying to lip read.
What would Robert Plant but it's, anyway, the re-
well, I have no idea. I don't know what they... Robert had a funny thing about Bowie. He was a big fan. But I remember he made a point once, and I said, we were listening to this song, and it was at one point, and it's... It was one of those things, you know, when someone points something out about someone and you can never lose it.
Yeah.
And he said, like, for another one that Robert Palmer did to me, which killed it, was when he pointed out to me, he said, oh, Jeff, I said, what do you think? Jeff Bridges, great actor, went, his tongue's too big. And now I can never, ever.
You can't see Jeff Bridges the same way again.
Without whenever I see him, it's true. All I ever see is this guy with a fucking tongue that's too big. But anyway, he said about Bowie. And we're listening to the song. It goes, oh, it's great. It goes, oh, except now, look, he's doing that atonal thing that he does.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, I think, where it goes, yeah. And that used to really bug Robert.
Really?
I can tell.
He
it's a thing where he just thought it's just kind of, it's like you can't be bothered to stay in the key you're in or whatever.
But didn't, I mean, you tell me, you knew Robert Palmer very well. He came from a very different kind of background, didn't he?
Well, he was, but he, in a very different way, in a very musical way. Mm. I mean, he studied musical forms incredibly. I mean, a lot of his songs are a lot more complicated than you think they are, because what you think is a rhythm is in fact four separate counter rhythms that he studied that come from the Ivory Coast or somewhere else. And it's... you know, like I said, when he was writing bossa nova songs, he would write English lyrics, but in words that were phonetically sounded Portuguese.
Right.
He was incredibly studious. Yeah, he wasn't so, you know, he didn't have the sort of literary and artistic tastes, say, the experimental tastes. But he was very, very expert, but it was, he was very driven in that, in his study of music and musical forms. Whereas I think Bowie's was much more playful around things like that.
Bowie was certainly very experimental, but it's interesting. I don't know if you remember the solo on this, but it, you know, it's incredibly distorted and angular and screechy. Baloo flew in and he was put in the upstairs studio and given headphones and wasn't given any idea about the song and just had to plug in and play it. And they composed the solo from numerous takes, overdubbed, chopped up, thrown around, and you get this fantastic solo, which just sounds awesome. You know, it just lifts off at the end of this track.
I love the story of him getting Baloo, of when he came to Berlin with Frank Zappa, and then he nicked him after the gig, and they went to this restaurant, and then Zappa turns up at the same restaurant, and he kept calling Bowie Captain Tom. Yeah, I love that. Didn't even give him his rank.
He went up to him and just said something like, hi, Frank. I mean, I'm really, really on to meet you. He just goes, fuck you, Captain Tom.
He's
so pissed at him for taking off his star guitarist. Because I think Adrian Belew went to Zappa's band and then just went straight to Bowie's band. And he played with Talking Heads. And who else did he play with after that? Do you remember? He was definitely with Talking Heads for a while.
He did a solo album, didn't it? Was it Love Rhino or something?
I don't know. Love Rhino, Christ.
And then it was King Crimson, isn't it?
That's it, King Crimson. I was thinking there was another band that was tangentially linked to Bowie, and of course you got the whole Fripp Baloo thing going on there.
I've had a couple of great drunken nights with Adrian Baloo, I must say.
Oh yeah,
he's terribly good fun. Yeah, I was doing my comedy show at some guitar festival in New Zealand or Australia. I can't even remember now. And he was there, and I've bumped into him at NAMM a couple of times, and he's an absolute delight. I love him.
I think for Red Sails, he said that he started it and he was feeding back as he started it, and just by one of those lucky strokes of fate, the feedback was in just the right key and just zoomed him in there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It must have been great. Have you recorded in Switzerland? Do you know this studio? Apparently it's the best studio in Switzerland where they did this.
No, I don't. What's it? Montreux? Oh, no. No, I haven't. I've played Montreux. No. Can't say that I have.
Because they recorded it in the studio, and the best part of the studio where Queen and all orchestras and all sorts would record was booked off all summer. They couldn't use it. So they had to put all the musicians into an upstairs room, and Brian and Bowie and whoever else was downstairs in a control room, and they had to monitor them on CCTV. And apparently the room was stifling, absolutely stifling. It was summer, and everyone was just playing in there, just shirtless, just getting through takes as fast as they could, then literally hanging out the windows, coming back in and doing another take. So it's fascinating to think how that environment must have affected the playing.
Just the sound of the record is, it's got that real bunker, slightly low. Mm. It doesn't make you think of Switzerland and posh studios. And, you know, it does have that basement feel to it.
It really does. A bit like Exile on Main Street or something, where the environment really soaks into the tape, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, we'll turn over to side two, as it was.
Turn over.
Let's turn over to side two, and we start off with DJ.
DJ, love this song. What I find interesting about this, well, there's so much I find interesting about it. I love everything about it. I love it lyrically. I love the feel of it. But what's interesting, if anyone sort of younger me heard this, the whole concept of the DJ was completely different back then. This is before, you know, before house music, the whole concept of the superstar DJ, the DJ being something sexy. I mean, DJs were naff. You know, you were either on the radio, in which case that was quite cool, but a club DJ was, no one aspired to that, you know. It was an entirely
different thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a totally, totally different thing. And it was fun. I'm sure you got girls and drugs and everything, but it wasn't a celebrity or anything. It didn't have any cachet.
You could be DLT if you were lucky.
Yeah, but he's talking about club DJs, isn't he? Because he's talking about it's the weekend and fast food. And
I got home, I lost my job.
Yeah.
Which somebody on Twitter pointed out quite accurately. They always used to think was, I lost my dog. It's very New York to me in the sound. And of course, New York, Studio 54, Mud Club, CBGBs, all these.
Exactly. Well, Mud Club was his hang, wasn't it? Yeah. He never did Studio 54.
I think Tony Visconti talks about when they were recording this, or they were doing the mixing, I think, in New York, which he always blames for the fairly shite overall sound. But he said that Bowie was really, really hitting the clubs in style at this point. You know, that Visconti would go there, they'd stay up all night, and then Bowie would
There's a thing in Visconti's book, isn't there, about his driver sitting outside the Mud Club at midday or something.
But yeah, I mean, thematically, lyrically, I mean, it could well be that cult of the DJ, which, like you're saying, was a very new phenomenon at that time, wasn't it?
No one going to a club knew who the DJ was. No one went for the DJ unless you were a regular.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Tone on tonight. There was no, you know, Fat Tony, you know.
Fat Tony on decks. Yeah. What do you make of that? This is another one with a very kind of Eno-esque Talking Heads influence. I mean, what do you make
very
of this
very song? talking heads. Yeah, I guess that's just Eno. I don't know. And it's that sort of template that's kind of started with Heroes, really. Well, no, it's maybe started before that, of this very straight ahead, where everything's very straight ahead fours, and this actually very old-fashioned type. It's a very old-fashioned type of bass playing. It's kind of it's like a sort of very square Motown. Mm. And it does seem to be quite, it's like a stock thing that Bowie just had ready to go off the shelf. I thought this feel.
It's got Simon House on it, the violin player. I think he used to play with Hawkwind.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And he's playing on this as well. He does that wonderful screechy atonal violin scraping towards the end, which really gives it another sense. It's a very dislocated
song. Well, also, I don't know if this is the one that started one of the absolute major 80s video tropes, which is of someone being in a room of some sort and smashing it up.
I think this did start it, yeah. I know you talk about this in your book.
I've been in so many videos where it involves the room, either the room destroys itself in some supernatural fashion, or someone smashes it up.
Didn't you point out that this had to be the case for children's TV? So things had to be.
That's right. There was an Ice House video, which was about, yeah, I don't believe anymore. And it was, and the whole thing, yes, it was this couple. It was the usual thing, like some model who's probably shagging the director. And you'd have the singer singing the song while she tearfully shouted stuff. Yeah. That was an absolute trope. And yeah, it was meant to be a sort of carry type thing with all the knives and crockery and cutlery going through. But yes, before children's set up, all had to be slowed down. So it was very funny scenes of Ivor sitting at the table with a sort of fork wobbling past him on a wire.
And you were also on the table, right? You were sitting at the table.
I sit at the table, I stand up and I turn, look at the drummer, stand up and slam my fist down.
That's it.
For no reason whatsoever. So I slammed their fist down, yeah. In an Anthony Price suit, obviously.
Was it the Brian Ferry video where you were playing double bass or cello or something?
Cello. The Derek Jarman directed. Yeah. Derek Jarman directed
Did
video
he?
That was, yeah. Full of whirling dervishes. It's a very good video, actually, I suppose. I mean, I guess. I don't know. Video seems such an abstract
concept. I've seen that video.
I was gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Something
in that.
Very important. Oh, God. Totally gorgeous. I can see why the ladies were lining up.
Downstairs in the kitchen, I've actually got Big Brian, very sweetly, a few years ago, just gave me two framed stills from it. And I do look preposterous.
Black suit and then the collarless shirt, right?
Yeah.
Which was de rigueur.
I'm wearing brown shoes. I'm wearing a black suit and brown shoes.
And then
you
had the curve.
Move along.
The bob, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was Yoji Yamamoto. It was probably about $3,000 worth of clothes, you know. They look like pajamas. I had a bob, like a bob, long bob. Yeah.
Oops, this bit got cut out for some reason. But I asked Guy about the video for DJ, and we got to talking about the trench coat that Bowie was wearing in that video. So here we are.
And there's that great thing of him being pulled, and he's wearing, because I remember he's wearing that raincoat that was, that everyone wore, punks wore. The trench coat. Sid Vicious was wearing one when he was arrested. I remember all the mods wore them. Ian Curtis wore, it was an absolute cross the board fashion thing. Of course I had one. It got nicked at and in true sort of Quadrophenia style, it got nicked at a party in Shepherd's Bush.
Well, if it's going to get nicked, Shepherd's Bush is the place for it to be nicked, isn't it? Pete Townsend probably had it. But the video was extraordinary. I think it was David Mallet who...
Yeah, I think it was Mallet. And there's that whole thing of him being poured in the street. People grabbing him. Again, another trope that was...
Was that a trope? Really? Being poured in the street?
Didn't that become a thing? Actually, no, maybe not. Maybe not.
Not
maybe
so much. You're bang on with smashing the plate against the wall because they actually do that in a kind of like jagged freeze frame. So it goes, it's repeated again. But he's walking down Earl's Court Road late at night, and there are all these people that just come up to him and start mobbing him. And
that's right, yeah. Oh, is it Earl's Court Road?
Earl's Court Road. I can't believe I know that. God. it's what I live on my own.
Christ, you're dull.
Yeah, exactly. this is why the dogs are asleep on the bed right now. But so that's DJ. It's got the very Talking Heads sound to it. It's got this slightly ambiguous lyric. We're not quite sure what that's about, but we're certainly not on the travel theme, which dominated side one. Here we're into another different territory altogether.
There was clearly something specific he wanted to say, or something that inspired this, because it is outside the theme of the album.
Does it remind you a bit of TVC15? Because it does me.
Yes, yes.
Next track, Look Back in Anger.
Jimmy Porter, who lives and loves with an intensity altogether frightening.
There's hardly a moment when I'm not watching and wanting you. Nearly 2 years of being in the same room with you, and I still can't stop my sweat breaking out, and I see you doing something as ordinary as leaning over an ironing board.
Now, I've got there's a thing, right, that people often say, oh, this song sounds like such and such, and I go, no, it doesn't, you know what I mean? And I've got a feeling about this one. This reminds me of something, and I'm sure I'm completely wrong. I'm sure there's no root. But rhythmically, as far as the groove goes, this just makes me think of Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin.
I can see that, yeah. I can see that.
I can't imagine him, it's that same sort of, but I can't imagine him being influenced by Led Zeppelin in any way, shape or form. Although maybe not.
I can totally hear that. Like you say, it's got that very propulsive groove to it all the way through. And it is fantastic, isn't it?
Exactly. And even there's a similarity in the guitar. Dennis on this is amazing. And it's that voice, it's that particular voice. Oh, he's doing that one.
he's doing the Scott Walker again. You know who I am, he said. Again, the video for this, I think there was another set of visual cliches that began here because he's doing the whole transformative thing. He's turning into the picture of Dorian Gray, isn't he?
Yeah. And again, this is clearly, unless you know there is an actual reference for this. I mean, it looks like it's clearly coming from something.
There's this figure of an angel of death. And from what I understand, the angel, he's portraying the angel of death as a rather lame figure that just sits in a cafe waiting for someone to die.
That reminds me of Woody Allen wrote these, I think it was one or two books of short stories, which were very, very funny. Very, very funny. But there was a great thing, the great thing about death turning up either at the wrong time or at the wrong house. I can't remember. It's really funny. And it's sort of, well, my favorite, and then for some reason, this makes me, I'm just wondering if he kind of got it from that, the idea of death just being this kind of workaday.
It's the idea of death as not something like out of a Bergman movie, but instead just sort of like a rather schlubby, shabby, forlorn figure just sitting there going, you know, flicking through magazines and just waiting so long. It could well just be that. Who looks back and out? The angel?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Someone
yeah.
looking back on their life? But again, this was the track, I believe, where Eno assembled the musicians and told them all to play random chords that he would point to, and which they didn't take kindly to.
But I can see, it's something like this, you can see that happening. It doesn't really, really matter because you've just got to think, it's going, there's a chord, then there's another chord, then there's another chord. It doesn't really matter what the chords are, really.
If you had been called into a studio and you were given a track and then you got an Eno-type character saying, all right, guy, now I want you to play this, now I want you to play that, how would you respond? Do you think you'd get into the spirit of it, or do you be like, well...
Depending on if it starts to sort of yield results kind of quite quickly, then yeah. But it's one of those things of, do you know what I mean? Give it half an hour and...
I think from what I've read, this didn't really yield results quite quickly.
Yeah, that shit gets old real quick.
There's one other thing on this track which I really, really want to talk about, which is the guitar. Carlos Alomar, we haven't really mentioned him yet, but Carlos Alomar is doing that amazing rhythm guitar solo in this, which is just beautiful.
Yeah.
I love it so much. Over the frantic backing. And how do you rate him as a guitarist?
Oh, fantastic. Brilliant. I love Carlos Alomar. Also, he was the first one of those kind of top session guys I ever met, and he was so nice to me. He was so nice. I remember going to, when I went to New York to do the Power Station thing, when I was snuck in just to play on it for a day, and so obviously I went and stayed with Sylvain, stayed for a few days, and I went for lunch with David Harper, Robert Palmer's manager, and we went to some, and everything was just so groovy. New York in the 80s, man. I was 26, and we went to this Japanese restaurant. And I was thinking, fuck, man, this is so cool. Because Japanese restaurants were, you know, were super rare. It was like being in a Japanese restaurant in New York was cool enough. But then there was Carlos Alomar having lunch. And he was like, guy, come on, you know. And it was really nice. He was only ever lovely to me. I love his playing. It's fun because he, you know, quite a conventional R&B guitarist. And you realise that what made a lot of his stuff kind of seem outside was that he actually stuck to his guns. You know, there's stuff sounded avant-garde by the sheer fact that it really wasn't. If you know what I mean.
I mean, he really, really was the band leader in many ways as well, wasn't he? He was really the guy who was keeping it all together.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is another fascinating part of Lodger, is the tension between the theory and the environment created by Eno and Bowie, and then this group of shit-hot musicians, Dennis Davis, George Murray, and Carlos Alomar, and the tension between that, I think, really gives this album something unique.
Yeah, no, that's very true. But what's interesting was talking to Phil Manzanera about how when they did 805, and he said the whole point of that band was you had two absolute super musos in Bill McCormack and Simon Phillips, and then Eno and Phil, Phil counted himself as a complete non-musician. And it's like, so you know, a lot of musicians like to surround like with like. And Eno obviously thrived on that tension of having super competent people and then not throwing in non-super competent.
Well, I think, I don't know if I mentioned this, but apparently, yeah, this is the album where there was definitely tension between Bowie and Eno. And Tony Visconti, Sean Mays, the keyboard player, a number of people did say on this album they saw that relationship really starting to fray at the seams. And they didn't work after this album together till 95 on Outside. So really, it had run its course. But really, when it comes to experimentation, we come on to the next track, Boys Keep Swinging. And here you have a, well, you tell the story.
So, okay, so we've now opened up. I've got into a big fight with John Karen on Facebook about this.
I saw.
I've also got into a big fight with John about, not a big fight, not at all. It's you know, he's my dear old friend. We're just having a discussion. Because also the thing about, I because Chalky Davis posted a picture of Mick Ronson and I waded in with my thing of how once Bowie parted company with him, he never wrote a musically complex song again. But yeah, so there's this. So Visconti says he played bass on this.
Yeah.
I just love this. This is just the everything I love about Bowie. It's that template which I love, that musical template, and we discussed all this before. Is that multi-layered irony of Paul Verhoeven? I believe I used as the reference for that. I can't even really analyze this so much apart from say I just fucking love it. I just love it. It's one of the, it's like fashion. It does seem an absolute companion piece to fashion. That's why I always thought the fashion belonged on this album.
Do you remember when this came out?
Yeah, I absolutely remember it coming out. I remember seeing him on top of the, I remember seeing the video on Top of the Pops at the time. But I've always loved Bowie at the time. That's a great, ever since, well, the first album that came out when I was already aware of him was Diamond Dogs. But yeah, from then on. Yeah, every Bowie album was an event.
I was thinking a lot about Boys Keep Swinging. I was wondering, glam rock was where men were wearing makeup and experimenting with sexuality. Did that kind of take a backseat post-punk, new wave? Was that not really a thing?
There's a very interesting thing. That whole thing about androgyny and blah, 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 blah. Actually, all British youth movements have had that, right? The mods had that. The mods totally had that. The girls looked like boys. The boys wore makeup and were very, you know, fussy about their appearance. It kind of took a, and then the whole psychedelic thing was incredibly camp. Glam was, you know, camp. And that's why I find it quite funny. Someone said there's a picture of Brian Jones at some party or some band launch event in 1969, which someone says you could probably say is the birth of glam rock, the way he's dressed and everything. And then, yeah, glam had all that. Punk obviously didn't have all that because it was sexless. But then, of course, you had the New Romantics came straight after that, who were ultimately, you know, all that all over again. It never really went away. Although the interesting thing was, all through the 70s, interesting, for all that androgynous boy, girl, and to the supposed freedom that had come from the 60s, Freddie and Elton and everyone couldn't say they were gay.
Exactly. That's amazing when you think
about it. It's extraordinary.
The biggest stars of the decade.
Think about it. It's the hypocrisy of that.
Day after they screened that video on Top of the Pops, the single literally plummeted out of the charts. Like Britain had a collective shudder of disgust.
I can understand Daily Mail Britain being absolutely disgusted, but that's not the Bowie audience, is it? I mean, that does seem weird. Oh, well, funnily enough, I've just read about this in, and I can't praise this book enough, in Pete Perfidi's book.
Oh, I want to read that next.
It's so good. And I've just come to this bit where every generation has its Starman moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And his one was Boy George.
Yes.
And it was exactly his dad going, "Who's that, a boy or a girl?" But the funny thing is, he said what was interesting from his young perspective, he said, now if I look back, and it's true, I've always been slightly puzzled. The Starman thing was, it was more the direct, it was him pointing at the camera he had his arm around Mick. But it wasn't the androgyny thing. That wasn't what was doing. That whole thing of, at the time, people couldn't tell if Mick Ronson was a boy or a girl. It's
right,
the funny things.
Right.
But Pete puts it beautifully. He says, but now you look at that now, and you're clearly looking at a hod carrier in drag. Nothing exactly. androgynous about it at all.
That's exactly true. So many people of a certain generation, especially, will find that Starman moment to be the ground zero moment, you know, when this was on national television at prime time. And with Boys Keep Swinging, that same dad who would be rustling his Daily Mail and peering over the top of it would be even more apoplectic with rage. The song itself is fascinating. When you're a boy, you can do this. When you're a boy, you can do that. Life is the pop of the cherry. It's got this real swagger to it.
Yeah, no, it's a sort of exhortation to join the Hitler Youth, isn't it? I mean, it really is.
That's another theme on Lodger, which is that Bowie's flirtation with far-right imagery really had gone by the wayside. And I think a lot of that was due to the fact that he was hanging out in Berlin. He was hanging out with all the...
Yeah, that'll do it to you.
If anything's going to do it to you, that's going to do it to you.
Johnny is a man.
Yeah, very... A lot of Lou Reed in that.
A lot of Lou Reed. A lot of suicide as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Good point, yeah.
It's got that little, that minimalist...
And it's very laudable, but it's quite weird to see him taking... It's quite an overt stance, isn't it? It's like an anti-domestic abuse stance. I mean, obviously, why would you not be anti-domestic abuse? But it's just quite overt for him. Do you know what I mean? It's very, very straightforward. It's like we're not used to him spelling out what he's talking about.
But I think that's what Eno was getting pissed off at, was the fact that he was being so overt.
Right.
You know, there's no enigma here. You could say that rather than being an outright, you know, polemic against domestic abuse, he's singing from the point of view of the perpetrator, of the aggressor, isn't he?
In many ways.
And he could have married this girl. He could have done this.
He could have.
One of the distinctive aspects of this is the bass for me. It's just that weird, slurry bass riff.
I think it's not a million miles from sort of Talking Heads. I think there's quite a lot of Eno in there still.
Definitely.
Especially with a damn, that's sort of slightly loopy feel to things.
And then he comes, there's no real resolution, is there? It's really uptight and...
Yeah, exactly.
There's no big kind of moment where everything's okay again.
Yeah, this sort of references Osborne almost in a way. It's like we've had to look back in anger. I love, again, it's another one of those standard bass lines he does, which goes back to, sort of goes all the way back to Fame, really. Like, it's that kind
it's
of...
Sister it's, Midnight by Iggy Pop, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's true. But again, but it's that kind of meathead funk in the book, which I love.
What a great genre.
I think I've just invented funk. A genre there, meathead funk.
You've just invented meathead funk. That is terrific. Tell me more about meathead
well,
funk.
Well, I'm trying to think. It's a lot of that New York stuff, isn't it? Yeah. Defunct James Chancel. I mean, I was thinking, because you got me thinking about, because there was this after, you know, from because punk was such a different thing in New York, and there was this sort of real crossover between what became, you know, you somehow got from television and suicide somehow made its way through Blondie to kind of Kid Creole, and you know. And you had, I guess, in the way that some Danceteria, I guess, was like their Hacienda. Mm,
yeah.
Do you know, in a way you could imagine Nick Cave playing there, as well as Nile Rodgers hanging out. So anyway, yes, the song. Well, it's the second song to have red in the title. Have you noticed that as a theme?
You know, the red thing is really weird because, okay, it's Red Money. And in it, he keeps going on about the small red box. And... in some interview, you said, oh, that small red box, it's from my paintings. And I think it means responsibility. And I think that's the fine one of the lyrics in this. Such a responsibility belongs to you.
Yeah, red money. I don't know. Was he waiting for investors from Russia for something?
Could be. Red sales, red money.
Yeah.
You know, the Soviet threat looming large.
Well, exactly. Yes.
It's interesting that he goes with an Iggy Pop tune and basically slows it down. And then slaps new lyrics on it. It's a very downbeat note to end the album on. An album which is really twisting and turning throughout every song. You know, there's no real overall feel to this. This is an album which is, like Bowie said, it's a hodgepodge of styles. So I'll give you this quote, actually, which is from Bowie. Shut up. Lodger is really a hodgepodge of styles that create a lovely sort of mix. The areas we've been working in are so undefined, I find them very hard to analyse. But I think probably a classification to give the album is that it incorporates just about every style that I've ever got involved with, apart from rock. There are three or four narrative songs, though, which is something I haven't done in a long time, and two or three of what you might call da-da pop, as opposed to rock. Now, whether that's the kind of pop that people expect, I don't know, but it's definitely Bowie pop.
I think it very much speaks to its time of being, I mean, you know, Bowie was very secure and comfortable where he was, you know, musically he knew he could go wherever he wanted. And it does seem to be speaking to the wider world of what's going on without sort of being slavish to anything. And it does seem perfect that, this might sound weird, but I think rather than being the album that comes at the end of the Berlin trilogy, it's the album that comes before Scary Monsters, if you know what I mean. It sounds like it's the album that's leading to that. Where it fits into the Berlin trilogy is more, I think, to me, it's more sonically than anything else. Like the fact that it has that bunker sound to it. You know, it doesn't sound like it people being decadent at the power station or anything. You know, it doesn't. And it's quite, I find it quite hard to picture them in Switzerland, frankly. If you look at this, the Under Pressure. And like, yes, that speaks to Switzerland and cocaine and everything, you know. Whereas this really, is that the same studio?
That's the same studio, but that's when they were in the big auditorium to do Under Pressure, whereas this was in a cramped little room. Just speaking of that, have you heard the 2017 version of this, the Tony Visconti remix of Lodger? He went and remixed it shortly before Bowie died. He started remixing it because they finished the album off in New York and they were stuck in a really crappy studio with very little equipment. They were under pressure, literally, to rush it out. And so there's a lot of people have commented on the fact that it was a very thin, muddy mix on Lodger. So during downtime on Black Star Sessions, Visconti started to revisit it and literally pull apart all the tracks and bolster up Bowie's vocals, you know, add in lots of little details. And apparently Bowie really liked it. He did three or four tracks before Bowie died, and then they completed it and they put it out on a box set a couple of years ago.
Oh, no. And because what I'm missing, it says here 2017 remaster, but that's not.
Well, they did the remaster and they did a remix.
Remix I'd like to hear.
Yeah, it's on Spotify and on most streaming things. I'm not a fan of it because I like the kind of airlessness of the original. When I heard the newer version, I mean, he's put echo and reverb on some of the vocals.
I'm in a cave full of bats.
And that was me and Guy Pratt, to whom I'm incredibly grateful for his time and quality chat. And if you like what you heard, I really do recommend his autobiography, My Bass and Other Animals, the audiobook of which is especially enjoyable, and it's all available now, as is the ebook and the paperback version, all online at the usual places. So if you do fancy some wonderful rock and roll anecdotes, that's the book to read or listen to. Anyway, like I said, don't forget to check out his YouTube channel where he's doing his lockdown licks session. They're very popular. Loads of people really love them, and I think they're very funny. And as you've just heard in this podcast, Guy spins a good yarn, or is it weaves a good yarn? Whichever one it is, he does that. And he also shows you how he plays bass lines, so, you know, it's a bargain. Anyway, that's it for now. New episode coming out soon. I promise to get it with you as soon as I can. But till then, stay safe, take care, and I'll be back with you soon. Bye for now, and thanks for listening.